The third case set for oral argument this morning is Plains Commerce Bank versus Matthew Jamie Moakley. Before we start the case, I want to introduce Judge Brad Zell, who's from the Second Circuit and agreed to sit with us this morning on this case and sitting in place of Justice Myron. So, Judge Zell, thank you for being here this morning. With that, we'll start oral arguments. Reed Rasmussen is going to be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Plains Commerce Bank. And then we have Josh Woogler, who's appearing on behalf of the intervener, appellee, Jamie Moakley. So, Mr. Rasmussen, you'll have 15 minutes on your initial argument, and you can proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. The Beck family farm was in serious financial trouble in 2015 when Matt Beck approached Plains Commerce Bank about a loan. Lived in 2010, Matt had entered into a loan agreement with Legendary Loan Link, which had also involved mortgaging of some trust property. And Legendary Loan Link had told him they were not going to provide any further credit.
Can I just talk to you for a moment about the genesis of that debt to Legendary Loan?
The genesis?
What was the debt for? What was it comprised of?
It was just an operating loan and a line of credit to basically keep the operation going, a typical farm loan. And as I said, they had taken a mortgage and then was cutting off the line of credit, which is what they needed to
thank you.
Going. So Matt approached Plains Commerce, wanted a loan. He didn't have sufficient collateral, so he proposed mortgaging trust property again. Plains Commerce got a copy of the trust, provided it to their attorney. The attorney advised them that it would probably be best, out of utmost caution, to get all the beneficiaries to consent. Matt was informed of that. He and his parents then hired attorney Danny Smines to draft a consent form. Smines was the one who originally drafted the trust back in 1999. The consent form was provided to all the beneficiaries, including the intervener, J.B. Meckley. They all signed consent form, which then allowed the operation to continue going. Unfortunately, eventually Mr. Beck and his defaulted, and Plains Commerce started a foreclosure in 2018. Jamie Meckley then, I believe it was June or July of 18, moved to intervene in the foreclosure action, which she was allowed to do, and then claimed that the mortgage was valid because Matt didn't have authority to sign it because he was self-dealing. This was almost 3 years after she'd originally signed the consent form and allowed the loan to be made of about $2.2 million so that the farm could continue to operate.
Mr. Rasmussen, you're a bit soft. If you could just pull that mic up a little bit closer.
Sorry.
Thank you.
SDCL 55-2-3 sets forth a rule that one, a trustee cannot self-deal. It provides exceptions. Paragraph 1 is the exception applicable to this case. If the beneficiaries consent, a trustee can be engaged in self-dealing. There are three contingencies. The beneficiary must have capacity to contract. There's no issue about that in this case. The third requirement is that there be no influence exercised by the trustee. In this case, there's indication that Matthew Beck had, in fact, it's clear, Matthew Beck had no contact with Jamie Meckley about signing the consent form. The second element is that the beneficiaries must be aware of the trustee's motives and have all knowledge of all facts that would affect their decision. There's really not any question about them being aware of Matthew Beck's motives. He needed the money to keep the operation going. It comes down to what other facts needed to be known. According to Judge Myron's decision, there were not sufficient facts known by the beneficiaries. And he cited both Betty and Brian Beck, who was Matthew's mother and brother, as well as Jamie Meckley. As far as Betty and Brian are concerned, both of them made it clear that they had no objection to the mortgage, even after being informed that maybe there were some facts they didn't have knowledge of. And so it's important that element two of the statute says that it must affect their decision. Well, both Betty signed a document after the fact, fully supporting the mortgage, and Brian, when confronted with information that he may not have had, said, that wouldn't make any difference to me, I'd have still signed it. So
Mr. Rasmussen, the question of that second question of the West's full knowledge of the transaction, are you arguing that you were entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law, or are you arguing that there are questions of fact on that issue?
No, I don't believe there are any questions of fact.
So you think that you're entitled to summary judgment, and if there, conversely, if there aren't facts to support your position, then Moakley is entitled to summary judgment.
Well, I certainly believe that the facts, there are no questions, and clearly we are entitled to summary judgment. As far as Jamie Meckley is concerned, Judge Myron cited two things to support his decision that she didn't have adequate knowledge. Number one, that she didn't know the trust existed until October 2015. Well, she signed the consent in November of 2015, so obviously at the time she signed the consent, she was aware of the existence of the trust. The second is that she didn't see this until after the foreclosure started in 2018. She had every opportunity to see the trust if she'd wanted to. She said she sent an email to Mr. Smines and maybe left one or two voice messages, but went ahead and signed the consent anyway, even though her husband and her father, her husband and her son advised her, maybe you should look at the trust before you sign it. But she went ahead and voluntarily signed it anyway. But beyond that, and probably more importantly, is that, again, the statute says that it has to be information that would have affected the person's decision. Well, in the intervener's brief, they said that if Ms. Meckley had seen the trust agreement, she would have known she could shut down this, as they put it, terrible deal. Well, she had full knowledge that she could shut down this deal. She testified to that in her deposition. She was point blank asked, did you think that Matt could mortgage the property if you didn't sign the consent? And she said, no, he couldn't. She also, she knew she had the power because she'd shut down a deal earlier. There'd been a proposed consent to sell land to Matt Beck. Mr. Smines had prepared, I believe it was Smines anyway, prepared a similar consent form. And Ms. Meckley at that time didn't sign it, and the sale didn't go through. So she had the power. So to claim that seeing the trust would somehow have affected her decision makes no sense. And so when you get right down to it, SDCL 15-2-3 clearly applies in this situation, because she knew of Matt's motives and she had information about all the relevant facts. And she went ahead and voluntarily signed that consent form, which the bank then relied upon a bunch of money. And it wasn't until the deal went south 2.5-3 years later that she then comes in and complains. The other thing was cited by the trial court relative to the applicability of 55-2-3 is the presumption of undue influence set forth in 55-2-8. But that really doesn't apply in this case. Both 55-2-3 and 55-8 focus on influence exercised by the trustee. Well, again, there's absolutely no evidence in this case that Matt Beck did anything to influence his sister. They weren't even on speaking terms.
Mr. Rasmussen, couldn't it be argued, though, that under the facts that Matt exercised undue influence through his parents, who were speaking with the beneficiary in this matter, to sign it?
Well, as far as the consent to mortgage document, I don't believe there's evidence that the parents did anything. I think Jamie Meckley testified the only person she talked to about it was Danny Smines. Now, the parents had talked to her about the consent to sale document, which she didn't sign. So I don't think they exercised influence. And besides, I don't know that both 55-2-3 and 55-2-8 talk about the trustee's influence. I don't think there's any evidence in this record that Matt went to his parents and said, hey, you've got to put pressure on her or whatever to make her sign this. But again, any pressure that was put on her, at least according to her own testimony, related to the consent to sell document, not the consent to mortgage document.
Does the application of 55-2-3, is that impacted by the specific provisions, the particular trust at issue? That's a provision with a spendthrift provision like this one had.
I believe so. I don't know of any. I mean, obviously, this court has and the legislature is supportive of the spendthrift trust, and they must be obeyed. But I'm not aware of anything that says that the beneficiaries can't consent or 55-2-3 is inapplicable if there's a spendthrift trust. I mean, obviously, there's authority on several cases that the court has to look to the intent of the trustors in large part, and clearly in this case, the trustors and the other beneficiaries all said to Matt Beck, you can go ahead and mortgage that property. And if that hadn't been allowed, they were facing potential foreclosure from Dairy Loan Link. I mean, this was a situation where the goal of the trust was to keep this family farm going. If Plains Commerce hadn't stepped in and made this loan, there's a good chance this farming operation would have been gone long before, because Legendary Loan Link had mortgages on the trust property just like Plains Commerce did, and they were cutting Matt off.
Mr. Rasmussen, just to clear up that fact, isn't it correct, as I understand the record, the prior mortgage actually was much larger, as $1.7 million or something like that, secured in part by the trust property, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and the trust existed at that time?
It did.
And was there a mortgage on the real estate that was granted into the trust in 1999?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Was there a mortgage on the property that was transferred into the trust in 1999?
I can't answer that question. I don't know. So beyond the consents, I believe we also have authority, or the bank also had authority, to grant the mortgages pursuant to the certificate of trust that was provided to them by Mr. Beck. That certificate of trust clearly stated that Matt Beck was the trustee and that he had to mortgage trust property. That's certificate.
Rasmussen, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just going to follow up a little bit with a question Justice Devaney asked. If the inquiry that we're in, the discussion that we're having right now, relates to the authority of a trustee to self-deal, and as we're describing, you know, these rules and we're talking about the statute, is that too myopic? Because is it possible that even if the trustee has the authority, or there's an argument that the trustee has the authority to self-deal, isn't there other provisions, or aren't there other provisions of the trust document that have to be contemplated before we get to the final answer of whether the trustee can mortgage this property or not, one of which may be the spendthrift trust, or excuse me, the spendthrift provision?
Well, again, I don't believe the spendthrift provision in a trust overrules everything else.
Well, do you believe the opposite, that the authority of a trustee to self-deal preempts everything else in the trust, including the spendthrift provision?
I guess if a trust had a specific provision that under no circumstances is the trustee allowed to self-deal, even if all the beneficiaries sign a consent form and permit it, or a provision that SDCL 55-2-3 does not apply to this trust, then I guess maybe the trust will rule it. But other than something like that, I don't know why 55-2-3, which is pretty clear that if the conditions are met and the beneficiaries consent, the trustee can be allowed to self-deal. And again, we're not saying that there wasn't some self-dealing involved here, because this certainly involved Matthew Dett's farming operation and his debt. But it also was a situation where the trust property was in danger anyway from the legendary loan link situation. And so this benefited not only Matt Beck individually, it benefited the trust to keep this farming operation going.
You would agree that he commingled his personal assets with the trust assets throughout this case?
I think that's true, yes, yes. But then my time's almost up, but just briefly, I think the certificate of trust also provides authority. It, again, was drafted by the same person who drafted the trust, and it provided Matt with that authority. Judge Myron said because Plains Commerce had a copy of the trust agreement itself with the spendthrift clause, that that the bank knew that the certificate of trust couldn't be valid. But it's not that clear. There are other provisions in that trust which indicate that the trustee would have authority under some circumstances to mortgage property, Section 6.2 and Section 4.1, which I won't get to and argue those, but it wasn't crystal clear that there was, just because you had a copy of the trust, that you knew that there was no authority to mortgage. In fact, the statute 55453 specifically says that. Just because you have a copy of the trust agreement does not nullify the applicability of the certificate of trust. I think my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wergler, you may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel, the central issue in this case is not 5523. The central issue in this case is not the certificate of trust. The central issue in this case is not the consent document. The central issue in this case is what does the trust say in Article 8. That's the spendthrift provision that this court is well acquainted with at this point. And that spendthrift provision forbids three broad types of conduct. One, no title vests in any beneficiary. Two, no beneficiary can use the principal or the income of the trust and make those liable for his personal debts. Three, no beneficiary may encumber or dispose of his interest in the trust prior to it being distributed to him. That is, as our legislature has acknowledged and as this court has acknowledged, a formidable barrier between a debtor and the assets of a spendthrift trust. And we have such important protections because when you put your land in trust, you are transferring ownership of that land from yourself to another in whom reposing a great deal of trust and confidence. And in order to keep that vehicle, the trust, on the road, we've got guardrails, which are the trust document. The trust document specifically says what the trustee can and cannot do. It grants power, it denies power. And in this case, Article 8 is an unambiguous denial of the power that Matthew Beck took upon himself to grant the mortgage to Plains Commerce Bank for his self-dealing personal debts and the personal debts of his wife.
Mr. Wergler, excuse me, but are you saying that once the entity of irrevocable trust is created, it can never be undone? It exists?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that.
So isn't it, would you agree the law is that if all interested parties, the settlers, the beneficiaries, even if they're remote, if they all consent to some act that would be otherwise altering what would be set forth in the provisions of the trust, it can be done?
It can be done depending on the language of the trust document. For instance, in this particular trust document, it says certain things can happen with consent to the beneficiaries. Now, that would be Articles 4.1 and 6.2. Those, though, do not have any clear and unmistakable language in them, as this court is required, authorizing self-dealing acts. Those are general powers to deal with the trust property for the exclusive benefit of the beneficiaries.
But then don't you default back to 55-2-3 and their provision?
No, Your Honor. Not when you've got something like the spendthrift clause we've got in this case, which is an absolute bar. Can it be changed, which I think is to your question that you just asked? Yes. We have the ability within the statutes and within our court procedures to go into court to revise trusts, revoke trusts, decant trusts. All of these options are there. But what do those options require? They require that the beneficiaries who are going to be doing those acts have full information about the nature of the transaction. And I would point out to this court, the trust document ended up in the hands of the attorney for Plains Commerce. It ended up in the hands of Danny Smines, the attorney for the Beck parents. And rather than go these routes of revoking or decanting, getting rid of Article 8, they come up with this consent idea. They put together a document that's misleading at best, and they put it in front of a bunch of beneficiaries who have no clue.
Well, let me ask you, what's misleading about the document?
The document says that Matt Beck has authority to mortgage, and he clearly did not have authority to mortgage in the context that that consent was being presented.
So who is that misleading to?
It's misleading to any of those beneficiaries, because they would come to that document and say, okay, well, it looks like Matt has the authority to mortgage trust property for his personal benefit. That's the implication of that document, and that's not the case. He did not have that authority. He could mortgage under certain circumstances within the trust, but those circumstances were not met here. They were, it's a general power to mortgage the trust property for the benefit of the trust. And I'd like to get back to a point raised by the banks come here that with this Legendary Loan business. Now, Legendary Loan was not a part of the bank's statement of undisputed material fact. Legendary Loan is a latecomer to these arguments. In fact, there's no evidence in the record to show who the debt belonged to other than Matt and Kelly. The promissory notes between Plains Commerce Bank and are with Matt and Kelly. The mortgage itself that Matt as trustee granted to Plains Commerce Bank refers to Matt and Kelly as the borrowers. There is no evidence that the approximately $2 million of loan from Plains Commerce to Matt and Kelly personally had anything to do with a trust debt. That's just not in the record. And the as Mr. Rasmussen noted, we've got undisputed material facts here, which that's really a little bit of a later analysis. I think the first analysis is, as you noted, Justice Salter, what does Article 8 say? And Article 8 clearly prohibited this self-dealing mortgage.
But isn't the conduct of all the beneficiaries and the settlers really the primary focus, because they're the ones that decide whether the trust even exists going into the future? So wouldn't you agree, Mr. Wergler, that the full information or knowledge component of the consideration of whether the consents were allowable or not would be a question of fact that should be fully expanded and determined?
It is a question of fact. However, we laid out in our statement of undisputed material facts exactly who knew what and when. They were all, for the most part, admitted. And the lack of knowledge is apparent when you read the admissions that the bank made to Meckley's statement of undisputed material fact. People didn't know. Jamie didn't know about this until 2018. Betty didn't know about Matt's $2.1 million of personal debt until her deposition in October 2018.
Well, but does that matter? We've got a consent that says the consent's limited to current proposed mortgage and any future mortgages, not to exceed $800,000. So everybody that signs that agreement's told, you know, there may be some future money here loaned out, and all you need, what you know, is that $800,000 of the trust is going to be subject to that mortgage. So does it matter if he has $500,000 in debt today or $2 million in debt, because according to this, he can mortgage the trust property up to $800,000. Would you disagree with that?
Well, I think I would answer that in two ways. First, the intent of the settlers is clearly expressed in the trust document itself. Look at Article 8. Look at the deposition of Betty Beck, where they put the land in this trust to protect it from the banks, to protect it from the nursing home down the road. And in fact, at the time of Gary's death, he was in a nursing home. He'd been there for a couple of years, I believe. And so that whole aspect, that's the intent we need to focus on. They put that in their trust. Now, to come back and say, well, we're only allowing $800,000 and that's all you need to know. Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because beneficiaries have a responsibility to make sure the terms of the trust are enforced. In fact, Jamie Meckley, the intervener in this case, is court ordered to protect the interests of the beneficiaries in this case because Matt Beck was not doing it. He was the first one trying to, he had hired his personal attorney to come in and represent the trust in this matter.
Well, but that all occurred after she signed the consent, right? In terms of her obligation to the trust.
Correct, Your Honor, and you're right. That happened later on in 2018. But regardless, Jamie could have come in, reviewed the trust document, and said, Mom, Dad, here's what you said, and here's what Matt is trying to do, and tried to determine, is there undue influence going on here? And, you know, opposing counsel notes that there's no evidence of undue influence. I would like to point out, and this wasn't a part of the summary judgment record in the statements of undisputed material fact, there is this document that they refer to in which Betty signed off on, you know, reaffirmed what she had done in 2015. I think it is dated 2018. But this document is really, it is a black eye on the legal profession, I feel. This document was prepared. It's at Clerk's Index 59. It's been referred to in the briefing. It's why I bring it up. This document was prepared by Matthew Beck's personal attorney and his wife's personal attorney. It absolves Matthew Beck of every act of wrongdoing he'd ever done with the trust. It waives all right to pursue him for any wrongdoing that he'd done. And as we know from our statement of undisputed material fact, Betty was largely kept in the dark with regard to this farming operation. She didn't know about the debt problem and things of that nature. But this agreement also absolves the attorneys for Matt in paragraph 11, saying that the beneficiaries, Gary and Betty, will indemnify, defend, and hold harmless the trustee and the trustee's attorneys from any liability, damages, losses, etc. And so that is prepared by Matt's own attorney. So who would have asked Matt's attorney to do that? Matt. That is clear evidence that Matt is trying to influence his parents with regard to this trust.
Mr. Werbler, let me ask you this academic question. Let's say that things hadn't gone wrong, and the consents that everyone executed worked, at least for the moment, and Matt was able to secure personal debt with trust property, and there was really no harm from that in the context that we see this case. What's the status of the spendthrift provision going forward? Can creditors now cite this ad hoc termination that, hey, the spendthrift doesn't really mean what it purports to mean? And so we're going to go after the trust corpus property now, too, because the trustees or the beneficiaries or the seller or whomever are really serious about this spendthrift provision at all. Does that corrupt the spendthrift provision? Because this isn't a restated trust. This isn't an amended trust. This is just sort of ad hoc termination by everybody. And I'll acknowledge, it does seem to be everybody, that it's okay. But what does that mean then for the trust going forward if we wouldn't have had this chain of events that we now see here in this case?
Well, in the context of this case, it doesn't mean anything because Jamie managed to get Matt removed as trustee a couple of years ago for his actions. And as far as I know, there are no other debt instruments out there that implicate the trust.
No, just a purely academic question. What would happen in any trust? I don't care if it's this one or not. There's an ad hoc determination that the trustee can self-deal in this way, and now we're going forward, and then maybe one of the beneficiaries faces personal debt or a question of whether trust property can be attached to satisfy a judgment somewhere.
Academically speaking, that would be a huge concern. Why would a trust and estate attorney put a spendthrift provision in a trust if it can be as easily undone as it is in this case? You've got situations where nursing homes are making determinations about Medicaid eligibility based on what's in a trust, what assets are available to the particular patient. If the court decides that these types of consents are in actuality some sort of revocation or amendment to a trust, then yes, going forward, other entities would be able to rely on those types of documents and say, this is actually an amendment to the trust. Now, it gets into a whole thicket of weeds, I think, because when you have a document that terms itself as a consent, purports to, as I said, misrepresent what the trustee's powers actually are, well, if that can be termed a revocation or a revision of a trust, then what else could be? What terms do we need to use? How do we need to do that? There needs to be some orderly way that a trust provision can be revoked.
Mr. Werkler, you'd agree this is a family trust used throughout the state of South Dakota, family farm trust, correct?
You're right.
And if this court affirmed the decision of Judge Myron, wouldn't this stymie commercial relationships between banks and trust as they go forward, even if unanimous consent of any interested beneficiary settler says we will allow our trust property to be used for this one instance or whatever the case might be? Wouldn't it stymie that? Because all banks would say, we're not going to do business with trust, period, regardless of how this plays out.
No, I think so, Your Honor, and that's because the banks still have an avenue, which is to give the beneficiaries full informed consent to show.
But isn't that a genuine and material issue of fact, not only knowledge and full information, but the extent and nature of it? You see, we hear about that all the time in civil action for damages, right? The extent and nature of it.
In theory, the facts surrounding whether consent was fully informed and given in a proper fashion would be a question. I don't disagree. In this situation, it's a factual issue that is there's no genuine dispute regarding. But yes, I mean, if the court decides in Jamie's favor on this case, this does not prevent banks in the future from providing trust, from making sure beneficiaries are fully informed of their rights and responsibilities. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Werkler. You may proceed with your final 5 minutes, Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you. Under the plaintiff's position here, a spendthrift trust basically outweighs everything. If you've got a spendthrift trust, that's it. You can't do anything. And it overrules 55-2-3. But importantly, there's nothing in 55-2-3 that says anything to that effect, nor is there any authority that I've seen that says anything to that effect. That statute specifically provides that if the requirements are met, beneficiaries consent to self-dealing.
Is the future creditor bound by that ad hoc determination? So let's say there's an unsecured judgment in the future. A trust has a history of making these ad hoc determinations that a trustee can self-deal with the trust property. What happens then? The judgment creditor says, you know what, beneficiary, I want to attach part of the trust property. The beneficiary says, sorry. Governed by a spendthrift provision, you can't have access to any of my debts or any of the trust corpus property to satisfy the debts. They've got this history of doing it, selectively relying upon the spendthrift provision when they want to and then when they don't want to. What's a creditor to do in that instance?
Well, I think the creditor, under 55-2-3, if the creditor has a consent signed by all the beneficiaries, the creditor should be protected.
They don't have a creditor. It's a different situation. They're out loaning money. They have a judgment against one of the beneficiaries. They want to attach trust property.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't understand your question. Okay. I don't think a creditor in that situation would have any rights. I mean, the spendthrift provision is still there. If a consent is given for a particular loan, then that creditor certainly has some rights. But some other creditor wouldn't have any rights just because the beneficiaries had consented to a particular mortgage, such as was done in this case, where it was limited to $800,000. That's all that the bank had a right to foreclose on. This question about, you know, the knowledge, again, I don't think there's any issue of fact in that regard. Everything in the court's, lower court's decision and in their brief, the only thing they talk about is the fact that Jamie didn't have an opportunity to read the trust. While she could have, asked for it. She made limited efforts to get it. But more importantly, seeing that trust, they haven't explained how that would have changed anything other than in their brief saying that, well, she could shut the deal down. But she knew full well how to shut the deal down. She's testified to that. She knew that if she didn't sign the consent, the mortgage wouldn't go through. That's no question about that.
Is one of the issues here, though, the affirmative or the statement in this particular consent, which stated, I am aware and understand that the trustee has authority or discretion to mortgage or encumber trust property. I mean, how do you reconcile that with whether or not that squares with this actual trust?
Well, first of all, you know, that was written by Mr. Smines, who drafted the trust. And,
understood,
you know, we've argued even without the consent issue that there was authority under sections 6.2 and 4.1 to mortgage. But beyond that, Jamie Meckley can't claim she was misled by that statement, because she clearly testified she knew that he could not mortgage a trust without her consent. And she had shut down the sale previously because she refused to sign the consent in that situation. Mr. Wergler, I think, made a misstatement when he said that she didn't know about the trust until after 2018. That's clearly not the case. She knew about the trust in October 2015. She didn't see the actual trust until after 2018. But again, they've never explained how it would have changed things if she would have read that trust document. And their arguments about Betty Beck not knowing how much debt Matt had is totally irrelevant. Betty Beck and Brian Beck aren't parties to this. They haven't objected to the consent. In fact, they've confirmed that they have no problems with it. So it really comes down to Jamie Meckley's knowledge, and she had the knowledge. She knew what Matt's motive was and failed to identify any other fact that she needed to make her decision, which was to voluntarily sign the consent and then try to back off of it 2.5-3 years later when the bank tries to foreclose after relying on the consent. If you rule in favor of the intervener in this case, then you basically are saying 55-2-3 is worthless. It means nothing if there's a spendthrift provision. Well, that makes no sense. I think there's spendthrift provisions in a lot of trusts. And so if the legislature had meant to say that 55-2-3 doesn't apply if there's a spendthrift, they should have said that. They didn't. So my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. That will conclude our arguments for today and our